I'm Greg Hunter. Welcome to USAWatchdog.com. Big goings on this week with Ukraine and with Russia, the U.S., Europe, the whole deal, the whole invasion that lasted, well, not long, maybe a day. I haven't had this guest on for years, and not because he's not a good guest, just because I've had an embarrassment of bookings, but he wrote a book 15 years ago, which is really important for me. This is all the globalist whole deal. The Truth About the Bilderberg Group, a huge book. It's about globalism, globalists, the plan, the roadmap. He has excellent connections, excellent analysis, sourcing. It's Daniel Estulin, and he's out with this book, and I just a few months ago, and it's the Globalist Project 2045.
Globalist Projects at War.
There you go. You can hear me in the background. Globalist Projects at War. It's Daniel Estulin. Another one of his fantastic books explaining what's really going on with great sourcing. Daniel Estulin, thank you for joining us from Mexico. And we'll find
Thanks
out.
Thanks so much for having me, Greg.
We'll find, you know what? I just want to start with that, actually. You're in Mexico. You were living in Toronto. And you made a decision, boom, snap, bang, right as COVID was taken off in Canada. Would you give us a condensed version of that, why you did it?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, my family loves skiing. So for my kids' spring break in March, we were going to go to Quebec, to Mont-Tremblant, actually, the place where the Bilderberg Group had their 1968 meeting where George Ball talked about the whole new concept at the time of One World Company Limited. In other words, corporations that have more power than any government on the planet. And so a day before, actually 2 days before the end of the second school term for the kids, Trudeau came on and talked about some strange COVID something or other. I didn't quite understand what it was. And then suddenly he said that, you know, because of some precautionary measures, they have decided, the government has decided, you know, to put the school back or off for another 3 weeks. And I thought to myself, this doesn't smell very good. So instead of going skiing and then coming back to a whole new reality, I changed my plans and I decided to come like literally overnight. We're going to Quebec on Friday. We changed our plans and on Friday we ended up in Mexico and on Sunday the government shut the borders down. And you know, the rest is history, as you say.
Well, a guy with your connections and your analysis and your sourcing, you figure that out. Wow, that's unbelievable.
It's actually common sense. You know, I've been around the blocks at least a couple of times. And, you kind of understand how government structures work. And when, you know, what they give you the heads up on this kind of thing and they tell you that school is going to be shut down, precautionary measure for 3 weeks because of some virus or other in China. Okay, and you understand the background to the whole thing is this global financial collapse. You say to yourself, maybe I should be as far away from this place as possible. And that's what we did. And that was the best, you know, one of the best calls in my life.
Yeah, you went to the, this sounds bizarre me saying this. You went to one of the freest countries on the planet, Mexico.
Well, Mexico is one of the, if not the freest countries in the world. There's never, not now or even in the darkest days of 2020 or 2021, no COVID restrictions, pretty much no masks, no tests, no anything. And so it may seem, you know, some kind of an oxymoron, but when you actually juxtapose what's happening in Mexico and you kind of compare it to the rest of the world, you have, I don't want to say tens of thousands, but you have thousands of European, American, Canadian immigrants moving to Mexico, Canada, United States, Spain, France, Germany, Italy, Australia, New Zealand, they're escaping, you know, their dictatorships and coming to Mexico.
And you can get ivermectin over the counter.
And you can get, exactly, you can get ivermectin. It actually costs like $2, two American dollars for, I think, was it two pills? I've never used it, but I think it was like two pills or four pills. I'm not sure what it is, but anyway, it's ridiculous.
You brought up the global meltdown, the global bankruptcy. This is, I'm sure, all part of how they're going to arrange this and make everybody a slave. Let's talk about the global bankruptcy. Explain.
Well, you know, again, we're looking at what is it, $3-4 quadrillion global debt. Okay. You're also looking at the end of a model, which is Bretton Woods economic model. You're also looking at the fact that the West capitalist world has no language to explain what this new world is going to look like. By language, I don't mean English or Spanish or French or Russian or any of these other languages out there. I mean the language of economics. And you can actually see that it's easy to prove since the 2008 crisis. What is it, like 13, 14 years later? How many economists won their Nobel Peace Prize? I think 17 or 18 people, mostly men, some women. Not one of these individuals, since the 2008 crisis, has been able to explain the theory of crisis. Like, the question is not very difficult. Ladies and gentlemen, can you tell us what's going on and how we are going to get out of this? They can't explain because they don't have a language, because the entire Western edifice, I'm talking about, you know, the School of Economics, whether it's Wharton School of Business, London School of Economics, think tanks, foundations, governments, all kinds of institutions, they all speak one language. And that language is the language of infinite growth on a finite planet within this Bretton Woods economic model. But if you actually look at it, and again, because I'm a doctor of conceptual intelligence, so what we do is we look at a bigger picture. I don't care about the minuscule, pity little things. I couldn't care less. But if you kind of, for example, start analyzing Davos, paradigm shift, great reset, globalization, the wars that we're seeing, you know, the world over. Okay, mind you, again, a great globalization is on its way out. And so you have this alternative multipolar world order based on the rise of independent civilizations, whether we're talking about the Russians, the Chinese, the Islamic world, etc. They're vying for their place in the sun. And so the key element of the global Western model is this liberal banking financier parasitical order. But for liberalism to be relevant, it needs an alternative economic model. Or say, in other words, an alternative language that doesn't exist at the time, okay, to explain the theory of post-systemic crisis. And if we look at the main stages in the creation or formation of liberal ideology, the Great Reset is not something accidental or transitory, because, again, globalization is the logical result of world history as understood by liberal thought. I want to explain this because it's important, because, again, I come from the Soviet Union. I'm a colonel of Russian, I've retired, but in any case, of Russian military counterintelligence. The world that I come from, we understand theory. In other words, to be able to explain the world around you, we understand whether it's communism, socialism, capitalism, Marxism, Leninism, it doesn't matter, liberalism, we understand the theory of crisis, we have the language to explain it. So to understand what's happening today, and it's not the Ukraine, it's not the dictator Putin, it's not the United States or Europe, we're talking about the end of the model. And so for this global liberalism, it's an ideology that what prioritizes the liberation of the individual form of all forms of collective identity. And so it began historically with Protestant Reformation and the abolition of the medieval strata of society. And as a result, you have this bourgeois society emerging, in which everyone basically is equal, however only in theory and in terms of opportunities. And if you kind of jumpstart to today, we don't want to, you know, bore the audience with 18th and 19th century history. Democracy has come to be defined as the rule of minorities against the majorities. Was that a deliberately criminal majority at any time under the influence of populist sentiments who can elect, you know, according to them, Trump or Hitler or whoever. And so Trump tried to defend the old understanding of democracy, but was overthrown. He was canceled. Like all these other figures, movements, countries on the path of this great reset, the last stage of this movement of liberalism towards what? This historical triumph. And the final stage for the liberals is the abolition of humanity. So we've gone from humanity, transhumanity, posthumanity. In other words, the politics of posthumanism. And so the liberation of this collective identity requires the abolition of species. And so the liberal futurists already praising the new possibilities of posthumanism, which is what Klaus Schwab, if any one of your audience would like to actually read any of his books, and I do suggest you read it, not because it's a masterpiece, but because we need to understand what these people are planning to do with us, and it's in black and white, it's right there. It's the fusion with the machine, which will greatly enhance body strength, memory, heightened sensations. Genetic engineering will help end disease, according to these people. Memory can be stored on a server in the cloud. Humanity will be able to connect with machines and achieve what these people understand as immortality. In other words, again, not concentrating on the little piddly things, the Great Reset is the triumph of liberal ideology in its highest stage, which is a stage of globalization. And all those who do not agree with such agenda, they're declared enemies of open society, and you get canceled. Well, you got canceled. And so they're encouraging, but or encouraged to voluntarily surrender, which is what the Americans have done with the point of the gun with the global revolutions. The British Empire has done, you know, all the Indians they killed. The Spanish Empire and the other Indians that they killed. Okay? So what you're reading is this whole progressive world, okay, with its unlimited finance, its military technical potential, its inexhaustible ability to control the imagination of humanity through all these global wars and color revolutions. And so therefore the Great Reset is this last rung, digamos, of human, I'm speaking Spanish to you, okay, let's say of human progress, which is understood by, you know, by the whole concept of liberal thought. Now, all humanity has been liberated. And all humanity, thanks to the liberals, is now free. Free to be liberal and nothing else. But keep in mind that at the same time, society is not free not to be liberal. And again, you're not a liberal, you're canceled. Because you're not a liberal. So if someone is an illiberal, just invented a word, or insufficiently liberal person is found, well, then the punish system, the cancel culture, is activated against these, you know, these people that are banished to this distant world of Neverland. Joking aside, we are at a critical stage as humanity, and Catherine Austin Fitz talked about this a lot, that will determine the direction of the world. And much is at stake for us, but more so for the liberals, because their model, which is based on infinite growth, is coming to an end. And the difference is that, for example, if you kind of look at it between the end of the Second World War and we talked about this, you and I, a couple of years ago when you had me last time on your show, the end of the Second World War and the end of the Soviet system, that's 44 to about 89 and 91, you have two different models. On the one hand, you have the liberal banking financier model, which was basically the United States and the satellites with a dollar system. And on the other hand, you have the Soviet Union with the Soviet bloc and the ruble. And these two systems coexisted. Okay, you had parity. In some ways, the West was much better. It was much more comfortable to live in the West than it was in the Soviet Union. In other, you know, aspects, the Soviet Union was much better. We had free education. We had free housing. We had free everything. You know what I mean? Free Medicare and education in some of the best universities in the world. In America, you want to pay $50,000 to go to a good university, well, you want it for free. And so, and in terms of demographics, you know, the two groups were fairly similar. But then, and so the West controlled 60% of the global market, and the Soviet space controlled 40%. But in the 1970s, the West reached the limit of its space, and they couldn't expand into the Soviet space because they would have, you know, been hit with a nuclear warhead. And so they needed to dismantle the country from within, because you couldn't just dismantle the Soviet Union with, you know, with the biggest army and the most powerful nuclear arsenal in the history of the world, you know, from without. So you have to do it from within. And so how that was done, it goes beyond the scope of this interview, but the point is, they managed to dismantle the Soviet Union by convincing, you know, the Yeltsins and the Gorbachevs to destroy the system, which was, you know, growing at a rate of about 11% a year in 1991, contrary to what you were told in the West. And so these two systems merged, and the West got a new lease on life, because they were able to expand into the Soviet space between 1991 and 2007. But then in 2007, the same thing happened. Okay, they ran out of space. And so what they call the Lehman Brothers collapse, the subprime crisis, it was simply the beginning of the end of a model. Okay? And so the liberals, they are aware that if their defeats and failures continue to pile up, then the entire 500-year history of liberalism will collapse with them. And so a multipolar world, to which Putin himself intuitively gravitated, directly criticizing this voracious, parasitical global order, as he said several times in his 2020 Davos speech, leaves the liberals without a single chance of success. And so therefore, they remove their mask, because again, while you have the alternative system, which is the Soviet system, they had to pretend in the West that such things as democracy, human rights, freedom of speech existed as an alternative to the Soviet system. Of course, it was always a lie. And you saw that recently in Canada with martial law, in Australia, in Europe, in Austria, in Germany, in Italy, et cetera, et cetera. But they pretended. But now there's no need to pretend. There's only one global system. Yes, it's on its deathbed, but it's still one. And so they took their masks off, and you see what you see. The whole principle of participatory democracy and et cetera, it's, you know, it's simply not true. It's always been a lie. And so the Democrats, driven by this logic of globalism, were willing to, in America, sacrifice traditional American institutions, democracy itself, to achieve their goal. But what they made, when they made it to the White House, I'm talking about the last elections with Biden, we're not going to talk about what they stole, it's irrelevant. They made it to the White House. They suddenly realized that it won't bring back the old glory of their model because the model itself is on its deathbed. And because of this, Putin's speech in Davos is even more powerful, symbolic, and eventful than his first warning to the West in his famous speech back in 2007 when he basically said, and I don't know if you remember it or not, it's out there, you can see it in, you know, on YouTube. I mean, it was gasps of oh God, this is the reincarnation of Stalin, because all Putin said was, we made a deal, we, the Soviet Union, or Russia, post-Soviet Russia. We made a deal with you, the West, the collective capitalist West. The deal which we're doing everything we absolutely can to fulfill our obligations to this deal. And the other side of the coin was that you were not going to expand into the Soviet space. You were not going to destroy our country, which is known as the rape of Russia. Okay, you're going to adhere to the, you know, policies of good neighbors. None of this was done. And so the West said, hey, we won the Cold War. We can do whatever we want. And again, Putin warned the West again for the second time in 2014 in Valdai, when he said, this is it. This is the last warning. And again, they laughed in his face. And so what happened the other day when he finally gave the order to attack, okay, or denazify Ukraine, you know, the West said, well, we didn't know this, how do you dare? Because we're actually, again, this global one world order, it's over. So again, I agree that it's not easy to understand if you kind of look at a historical background of liberal ideology.
Everybody's talking about World War III. Paul Kirk Roberts came on. I thought the same thing. They said, they broke. I mean, Europe has $18 trillion in unpayable debt with negative interest rates. They don't have a bond market. That's debt masquerading as an asset. So how are they going to fight Russia? I mean, if you listen to all the Boris Johnson and you listen to Biden, we're not going to have any troops. We're going to sanction them. That's going to backfire hugely, isn't it? You're talking about a global bankruptcy. Are all these sanctions on Russia going to backfire?
Well, actually, you know, as a Russian, I have to tell you that, you know, we are extremely grateful to the West. And the harder the sanctions, the more severe the sanctions, the better for us. Because, you see, what few people understand, and again, seeing the events today, yesterday, or this over the past week or so, you know, you realize how removed from reality most people are in the West, because they think Putin is the president, he's the dictator, he's doing... No, actually, that's not the case. The way the power structure works in Russia, Putin is the president, and he controls the military apparatus, the intelligence, etc. But the prime minister, okay, he controls the economic part of the country. It's not like in the United States, you have the president who is, you know, a guy who does everything, and the vice president, would, you know, goes to parties and drinks, you know, drinky poos. No, it's not. It doesn't work like that. Oh, in Canada, we have a prime minister who is really a president. In Russia, the president is the link between the sky, okay, the heavens, and the people. It's the protector of the people in the name of the heavens. And the prime minister is somebody who works the economic part of the government. And so, for example, in Russia, the entire edifice of the economy, the central banks, the financial institutions, etc., they're all controlled by International Monetary Fund. I know it makes no sense. And you tell me, well, that doesn't make any sense. Why doesn't Putin just, you know, fire the woman who is the director of Russia's Central Bank? Because again, keep in mind that Russia has been in a downward spin since the last trimester of 2012. That's 10 straight years of continuous financial and economic collapse. And Putin can't get rid of her, because if you were to dislodge her and put someone else in her place, Nabiullina, who is the director of Russia's Central Bank, would be like an equivalent of Jay Powell in the United States. If you were to get rid of her and put someone else, like, for example, Sergei Glazyev, who is a Russian economist, a doctor of economics, one of the, you know, key ministers in the new Eurasian Union, the International Monetary Fund immediately, okay, would produce a report saying that the new director of Russia's Central Bank is an incompetent boob, and therefore Russia's credit rating is going to go to where? To hell. Okay? And there's, because the private corporations, like Rosneft, for example, one of the biggest companies in the world, can have a higher credit rating than the sovereign government, the entire structure of Russia's economy will collapse in less than 24 hours. It's in a nutshell, okay, in a very simplified version. So for us, for Russia, to be able to get rid of a traitorous director of Russia's Central Bank for the past 10 years has been doing a little bit less because she hasn't been there 10 years, but the previous individual is basically doing the same. She's doing the same thing that the guy who was there before was doing, also in the name of International Monetary Fund. And so if he were to eliminate her, the entire Russian structure, Russia's economy will collapse in 24 hours, just like the Ukrainian army collapsed in 24 hours. And so for us to have a chance at actually getting our economy back, we needed a Donald Trump. Not because Trump worked for Russia, because, you know, we had Donald Trump because of some secret archives and he was, you know, we were blackmailing him. Because we were not strong enough, although we are military. Okay? Globally, financially, we are not strong enough. And the United States is. So Donald Trump, as the president of the United States, had the power to dismantle and destroy the global liberal banking financier order. And he was able to do quite a bit, but not enough. And the fact is that he lost the elections, or the elections were stolen. It's irrelevant because Trump didn't have the fortitude to go to the barricades with the American flag and said, we're going to defend freedom. Because it's one thing, you know, to start a revolution. It's another thing, actually, to keep it going. And it's another thing, you know, to defend it. And he wasn't willing to do that.
But I wanted to, they're talking about all these sanctions. And your quick pick on, because you're talking about a global bankruptcy. Governments are going to fail. That's what Martin Armstrong, a lot of the people, that's what the reset is. Are these sanctions going to hasten the global bankruptcy?
Most likely. But again, the United States and the collective West, they have no alternative. There's nothing else they can do to us. I mean, they can turn off SWIFT, but we have our own system. Germany said they're not going to allow that.
But I don't mean a bankruptcy of Russia. I mean backfiring natural gas to heat homes in Germany has skyrocketed.
Well, absolutely. Corn is up. Absolutely, you see the consequence right now. And so, what's going on right now? If we kind of bring in the Ukraine and Russia angle into this. As you said, you know, in the beginning of our interview, the United States have a $30 trillion debt, inflation at the highest level, 50 years? And so in this situation, the United States is betting on a scenario in which Europe will have to pay for the difficulties in the American economy, including buying American liquefied gas at exorbitant prices to replace Russian blue fuel supply through pipelines, for the reasons we all know. And so ultimately, it's about turning the European Union to this economic and geopolitical island, breaking off all ties and contacts, you know, with the Eastern direction, which is Eurasia, Russia, etc. And then being cut from the rest of Eurasia, so this island of Europe, let's call it, will become completely dependent on what? On the United States. And the European economy will become some kind of a surf space, serving the American lords.
They want this to happen.
Well, of course they do, and in addition to the economic agenda.
Thank you.
Let's not forget the geopolitical agenda, where you have the ruling financier and political elite in the United States betting on the maximum weakening of Russia. Okay, Russia is, for these people, is not only the main military adversary, okay, because Russia has taken the lead thanks to the creation of hypersonic weapons. Russian technology is unparalleled. No one has what we have. But also it's an ideological adversary, inviting the values against which the American global liberals, you know, LGBT plus elite, is waging this full-fledged cultural war today that I mentioned earlier. And so with the help of this new round of sanctions, the ruling elite in the United States, which is again is not a homogenous group, they expect to bring down the Russian economy, provoke this discontent among the population, destabilize the political situation, and hope somehow that people will rise up and blame it on Putin and say, let's get rid of him, let's replace him with, I don't know, Yeltsin-like figure, someone willing to sell the country to the global financial interests. But again, the problem is that European partners, they're not very enthusiastic, Greg, about what's happening.
All right.
First of all...
Wait, hold on. I just want to come back here. I'm not as smart as you. So this ain't going to work. This is not going to turn the Russians against Putin. This is not going to bring down Russia. This is going to hurt the West. Is that your statement?
Well, it's going to hurt the West. Absolutely, it's going to hurt. I mean, Russia, I mean, obviously, if they bring these draconian sanctions against us, short term, it's going to hurt. And it's going to hurt a lot. But, like, for example, look what they're doing right now. They're saying, I don't know if you saw, just how absolutely removed from reality European leaders are. The guy who is in charge of European foreign policies is a Spaniard by the name of Josep Borrell. He said the other day, it's like, I'm not making this up. He published a tweet and then he removed it once he realized, or somebody told him, this is really stupid. Because he said, well, now, because of these sanctions, you won't be able to go and shop in Saint-Tropez, or Paris, or London, or Rome, as if Putin and the like, we need to go to London and Saint-Tropez to shop. And so the point is that these people don't understand what's at stake. Because we're talking about a global liberal banking financier model. And so their way of understanding reality has got to be one for the entire world. So they will not allow an alternative view. But you are going to have alternative views. Because even London, okay, which is allegedly with the United States, although they're really not, are working very, very hard to destroy Europe and to create an alternative model.
And you were bringing up in the pre-interview that they have a, and nobody knows about this, you do, because you're Daniel Estulin, they got a deal with China, the UK, London, City of London.
Well, if you look at the proposal of the British Foreign Minister, Liz Truss, the famous Liz Truss, who doesn't know anything about geography or history, who came to Russia last week and, or 2 weeks ago, and embarrassed herself in front of the entire world. But if you listen to her, you know, her proposal on the advisability of including China in the creation of this new architecture of European security. Now, if you think about it, it's like, you know, when I first heard about it, I was in the kitchen, I was listening to the news, and I was washing dishes because I really like washing dishes. It relaxes me. Okay? Don't ask me why, it just does. And, you know, when I heard her say that, I said to myself, like, did I, you know, hear wrong? You know, and so one has, again, you know, kind of the thought to include an Asian state, because China is Asian, in the system of European security. Wouldn't it be more logical for the British, for example, initiative to include China in some kind of an Asian security system? Where is China and where is Europe? Look at the map. Now, maybe Truss doesn't know this. And alone, I know most people don't know anything about geography. But have a look at the map. Europe, London, China. So I think that the British idea, again, from the conceptual perspective point of view, the British idea on China may have completely different goals, because when I started thinking about it, it actually made a lot of sense than what is being publicly stated. Now, what does it mean? What does Britain need? It needs a Europe, not one where China plays an important role, but where England plays an important role. After all, you know, the whole Anglo-Saxon policy comes basically down to cutting off China from Europe. Why do you think, you know, that they've come up with this decision to create AUKUS? Australia, you know, the United States and England, you know, to fight against Russia. No, we're nowhere near there, you know, as a kind of front against China. Remember that, again, if you kind of look historically, the favorite tactic of the British Empire has been eliminating rivals, is to draw them into alliances and then destroy them. Which is why the British proposal should alarm China quite a bit. Now, England does not need Europe with its security. England does not need China with its interests in Europe. England needs to put a knife in the back of Europe, China, Russia, the United States, and regain its former power. Because one of the problems with England, I talk about this extensively in the book, which my publisher, Chris Miller of Trident Press, sent you, The Global Projects of War, is that after Brexit, which was one of the intents, the other one was BRICS, of regionalizing the world economy, they have no market. Okay, they're out of Europe, they have no market. Their idea was to join forces with the Arab world, you know, Sunnis and Shiites, and create their own market. But for that to have happened, they needed to present something to these two groups, which have been at war with each other for since Prophet Muhammad was in diapers, okay, that both sides would accept, the Shiites and the Sunnis. And that something was Israel's head on a platter. Now, this isn't some wacky conspiracy theory. Henry Kissinger, Lord Jacob Rothschild, two individuals who are very well informed, have said this back in 2012. Kissinger in the New York Post and Rothschild, I can't remember where he said it, but he said it. And they both said that Israel by 2022 is going to disappear. So the idea for London as one of the global projects was to create an alternative regional market for themselves. A market for it to be a market needs between 300 and 500 million people. And so the idea was to get these two groups with England and giving them Israel on the planet. That didn't work out. Because for that to have worked out, they needed Hillary Clinton to win the elections. She lost. Trump came in. And so England, they came up with their plan B, Macron, which is basically a carbon copy of, Napoleon III. I'm not going to go into it right now. It's too complicated. It's in my book. But what I'm trying to say, to go back to China and England, okay, sorry for getting away from it for a second, is that the key part of the power struggle is China. And this must be remembered as to China, if you look at the map and you know anything about history of China, in its southern part is still under the strongest influence of England historically. And I'm talking about not only the People's Republic of China, but the Chinese states beyond its borders, Hong Kong, Singapore, Macau, Taiwan. And in the People's Republic of China, these are provinces of the south. Guangdong, Fujian, Shanghai, that is port trading territories where the Chinese Komsomol members, in other words, people who control foreign trade and affiliated with the Democratic Party in the United States, run the game. These are the same people who ran the opium trade with the British back in the 19th century against the nationalist dragons, which basically Xi Jinping and his people. In other words, inviting China to become allies in European affair may very well be an attempt to strengthen the group opposing Xi Jinping. But there is also another version of this English initiative, because again, remember, the British have been doing this for a very long time. If you kind of, you know, with regard to China and the Anglo-Saxons, I'm not talking about individual states, so I'm talking about groups, global projects. And if you kind of look at Southeast China, you're talking about Southeast Asia, sorry. You're looking at two groups of nations fighting each other. On the one hand, you have the Chinese five, which is China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Macau, and Singapore. And on the other, you have the Anglo-Saxons, the United States, England, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. And the competition in terms of trade is not between countries, but between these two groups. And so the Chinese and the English speak, I'm almost finished, and the English-speaking groups, they have greatly penetrated each other over the centuries for obvious reasons. And so the ruling class of the People's Republic of China is not united. Okay, there's a fierce internal struggle going on, just as there is in the United States, where, for example, in China, the Chinese sub-ethnic groups oppose each other, and they organized, you know, on one hand, the army, which is the nationalists or the dragons, who are with Xi Jinping, and then you have the Komsomol members who are, you know, they have a different dialect and also business dealings are much more closely linked with the Democratic Party in the United States. And so these are the kinds of things we need to keep in mind if we're to understand from a conceptual, from much higher up, how these two elements work. And so despite this, you know, sharpest competition within each group, the Anglo-Saxon group, they show more solidarity, you know, than the people within the Chinese People's Republic of China. And so inviting China to participate in this European security structure may serve the purpose of, you know, maybe increasing the influence of England in the English-speaking group, working with both Europe and China. And what are the goals? On the one hand, strengthening of this pro-American group on the eve of the elections in the People's Republic of China, and also in November of this coming of this year, and also the strengthening of its own influence of the subgroup, maybe the goal that England really pursues by inviting People's Republic of China to participate in the European security affairs. And this does not rule out attempts to push Russia and China against each other on the European field, including China, to the western line of on Ukraine. Okay, and this is obviously, you know, the tried and true method of the English tradition of divide and conquer foreign, or divide and conquer foreign policy.
I want to get a little more focused here to, to this year. I don't know if you can boil this down to what's going to happen. We have 30 Democrats in the House going, oop, bye-bye, I'm leaving. They're just taking their money and running. You can get it tax-free. I believe that's the case. And where do you see what's happening here in the United States and the world for the rest of 2022?
Well, when I talk about global liberal banking financiers, I'm not talking about a political party. It's a global phenomenon. Okay? You have the same people, global liberal banking financiers. These are the people who are these liberals? They're the people who take no responsibility for anything at all. And their model worked for the time that it worked because they have this printing machine that printed money. They could use that money, which is U.S. dollar, okay, and the power of the American military to bring democracy to the nook and corner of the galaxy. But that doesn't work anymore. And today, again, you have this global debt of $3-4 quadrillion. And so as these bubbles continue to grow, you know, since the 2006-2009 crisis, very few people understood that the last crisis was a rehearsal with none of the underlying problems solved. And so they've been printing and lending, $140 trillion, if I'm not mistaken, since 2006. And so the problems and the risks were made exponentially greater. So, and if you look at it today, again, you know, if I'm somebody working with, what's the president of the United States' name? Joe Biden. Easily forgettable, okay? If I'm working with Biden, I'm the guy who actually runs the economic part of it, and actually understand what's going on, I sit down and say, look, we're in the winter 2022. We have debts, unfunded liabilities, derivatives of about $3 quadrillion. And it's a sum for people who are listening to this and say, well, what does that mean? It's almost 50 times, you know, global GDP. It gives the idea that there's no language, no model to describe the world beyond the crisis. And so we're in the final stage of the game. So you have all these people saying bye-bye because they understand that this is it. And they don't want to be the ones holding the bag, aside from the fact they probably understand they're going to lose. Okay, so the end of the end could be extended, you know, further a little bit longer or shorter. It doesn't make a difference. It's statistical noise if you kind of extrapolate.
And what do we get? I'm sorry to cut you off because what do we get if this system goes bye-bye? I mean, no pensions. No money.
Well, again, these bubbles can end up in one of two ways. Implosion or explosion. Most likely scenario, they explode. And so the principal bubbles we're talking about is the financial system, stock markets, bond markets, property markets. So in principle, we're looking at, you know, two options for the end. The net result is always the same, although the explosion finale will be more violent, lead to, you know, to quicker massacre than the implosion. What we're seeing right now is that what is coming in the global financial markets is going to be much worse, a time and a half, maybe almost two times worse than what happened in 1929, 30, 31, 32 period. Which means that the future generation of my children are going to be infinitely worse off than my generation and generation of my parents actually went through the Second World War. It means that the level of living for the people in the West is going to be something that they have never in their lives imagined. The kinds of things that are coming to America and to the collective West is what you see on television, you know, in Netflix films when you're talking about, you know, World War III zombies or some kind of, I don't know, horrible films in Southeast Asia. But it's coming home because the United States is in the same position, Greg, that the Soviet Union was in the last few months of its existence in 1991. And in fact, you have the president by the name of Joe Biden who has dementia, for God's sake. Okay? And they have to pump him up with drugs to get him to say something semi-coherent for no more than 30 seconds. This is a carbon copy of Leonid Brezhnev, our leader back in the 1980s before the eventual collapse of the system. So the same metaphorical trade, okay, which in 1991 caused the whole destruction and dismantling of the Soviet Union, and in fact, between 1991 and 1998, 26 million Soviet citizens died as a result of starvation, depression, drugs, alcohol, suicides, all kinds of things, and most importantly, because 40% of our countrymen lost everything that they had, you know, saved over the entire history of their country. And if you kind of expand this into the Soviet space, Soviet and the satellites, between, for example, in 1989, in the entire Soviet and satellite space, Soviet Union was almost 300 million people, looking at about half a billion people. There were only 14 million people living under the poverty line. 14 out of 500 million. Wow. In 1996, 7 years later, Greg, these 14 million, with the destruction of the Soviet space, etc., became 168 million people. So from 14 million to 168 million people who live below poverty line. And the same thing is going to happen in the West and the United States. But there is a difference, you see. And the difference is that we historically have known how to suffer. We had to fight the Second World War, the First World War, the Revolution, all kinds of things. And we know what it is to starve. We understand what it is not to have. We understand what it is to defend your country, you know, the cost of your life and lives of millions of other people. In the United States, you don't know that. You've never had a war on your territory. Grenada, Iraq, Panama, it doesn't count. Okay, it was somewhere else. In a lot of these cases, you know, you got your ass kicked. But the point is that we can suffer. We can sleep in the snow. We cannot eat. We can survive 40 below zero. You can't. And because every country, again, it's easy to calculate. Every human being has a lifespan. You know, we can live 75 years, 80, 85, 90 years. But countries have a lifespan as well. There are cycles. For example, Russia has a 100-year short cycle and a 600-year long cycle. Europe is at 244 years, out of which 177 years is peace, the rest of war. The United States has an 80-year cycle, give or take 2 or 3 years. What does that mean? Okay, if you kind of go to the beginning, you know, to Mayflower, the history of the United States, the first period, we're talking about the end of the 1600s, and we add 80 years, give or take a couple of years. And that takes you to the Revolution, 1776. The next cycle of 80 years takes you to 1860. That's the Civil War. The next 80-year cycle takes you to 1940. Well, that's the Second World War. And this last cycle, okay, takes you to 2020, 2021, 2022. And if you look historically on the United States as a nation state, it has always been able to get out of, you know, difficult situations, okay, or via some kind of a global war or local conflict. Revolution, Civil War, Second World War. Well, you can't have a global thermonuclear war right now. Too many countries have weapons of mass destruction, and you really don't want to fight against the Russians, okay? And so the point is, or the Chinese. And so the point is, you need something else. And so what's coming right now, the United States, is this, you know, point where they have to decide fork in the road. And I talked about this 8 years ago for the first time. In 2014, we talked about this, okay? That there's a very highly likely scenario where the United States is going to go away of a civil war. Now, it still may happen, and it would have happened had Trump not chickened out, okay? And so, I'm not promoting civil war death in America.
No, you're just giving it out.
But civil war, I want to explain this. It's important because I don't want people to think I'm anti-American. Okay, I'm pro-Russia because that's where I am, but doesn't mean I'm against the United States because, again, the United States and Russia historically have been allies. If you kind of look at the history, and it was not for us. The United States may not have been there after the Civil War. But anyway, it's another story for another day. But the point is that, what was I going to say? And I can't remember now. I can't remember what I was going to say. Anyway. The United States,
Go ahead.
So the point is that the whole idea of the Civil War, the United States is a house divided upon itself. And any organism that is at war with itself cannot survive. We know this. And so the United States needs to solve these differences one way or another. Okay? And these are fundamental differences between two absolutely different ways of understanding the world. And, you know, in the beginning of the interview, we talk about, that's one of the reasons I wanted to explain historical liberalism and where it comes from. As we have two Americas who absolutely despise each other. And there's no, you know, middle ground here. You can't elect somebody who both sides like. It has gone too far. And one side can only exist at the expense of the other. And this is what liberalism has done throughout history. Okay? You keep expanding your area of influence and you're living at the expense of someone else. That's called being a parasite. You live at the expense of someone else. You keep stealing and stealing and robbing and killing and destroying until there's nothing to steal. And then you say to yourself, well, what do we do now? What do? We expand into space? We go underground? What do we do? And so the point is, the United States needs, and it's probably the best thing it could do, it would have been the best thing, that when Trump, instead of chickening out, said, let's go after them. And so the Civil War in America, which would probably have lasted a year, maybe a little bit less, would have solved all these insurmountable differences between these two sides who absolutely despise each other. Okay? And that would have meant that because the United States is undisputed number one technologically, socially, politically, economically, in every sphere of influence, they would have come out on the tail end of this conflict, internal conflict, having solved these differences, and still would have come out on top and still be number one, but without these internal contradictions, which it needs to solve, because they're the same contradictions we see globally in the financial markets. Now, the problem being solved in 2008, which means putting in a receivership a large part of the global financial architecture, which are parasites, they don't produce anything, okay, it would have helped the world to solve a lot of the things we're seeing right now, which can no longer be solved. And so to summarize what you asked me, I mean, we're coming into some serious pain moments for the global economy. But again, we, the Russians, are used to suffering and not having and having to live on nothing. And being cold, you are not. And you have no idea. And again, we know that you don't know because when the COVID thing started in March 2020, Americans went to Costco, bought toilet paper and Coca-Cola. I guess they're going to sit in the toilet and drink Coke because I don't understand it otherwise.
You know, the Russian ambassador said the same thing. He said Americans are... going to get, this kind of just flew right over the top of everybody's head. Americans are going to suffer like they've never suffered before.
That's absolutely, I mean, it's a consensus. And one of the things that's happening right now, it's another very
important thing. That's what he meant.
Well, that's probably what he meant. I mean, so one of the things we're seeing right now is you could see that there's no time left. Catherine talked about this. I think it was in your interviews, it may have been in another, but anyway, she made a very good point. That there's about a year and a half left max before the system snaps into place. I totally agree. And so what you're seeing right now, you're seeing this mad, you know, a dash against the clock. And this thing coming at you at this metaphorical speed of 200 miles per hour hurricane is going to wipe you out. And so they're trying to outrun this hurricane, committing and making a lot of mistakes. And one of the things you're seeing right now, for example, what's the epicenter of the world? It's Moscow. All these leaders are going to Moscow. You have the, you know, Scholz, you have Macron, you have the British, you have all these kinds of, you know, today the guy from Pakistan, Khan, he's there. Or last week we had Bolsonaro from Brazil. Okay, you can say these are peak countries. Well, it doesn't matter. The point is that everybody wants to do business or discuss things with Putin because he is the senior statesman right now, globally bar none. But the problem for the rest of the world is, for the first time in a very long time, Russia has time, and we can afford not to do something or anything. The rest of the world doesn't. And so you're seeing this edifice is about to crash and dismantle the global order. We have everything. We are the sixth of the world. We have all the natural resources the world over. You know, oil goes up, you know, we make billions of dollars. Gold goes up, we make billions of dollars. We don't care what these natural resources cost in the global market. We have no need for the spot market. It's because we're using it for our own consumption. And so the necessity for the global collective West is to destroy Russia because they need our natural resources to survive, except that that can no longer be done. They had a chance in 1991, okay, when we are totally destroyed. And they failed because they thought we would just, you know, go away. Well, we didn't. And now Russia is back. The collective imperial Russia, because once an empire, and always empire, okay? Because we're always an empire. We're never a country. And that's something that the West never understood, as they don't understand the essence of who we are today. When Borrell and Scholz and all these other people, and I can't remember what minister of defense of what country, some pipsqueak little country in Europe, who's not on friendly terms with her brain, basically said, well, that's it. You won't be able to go shopping on the weekend to Paris. Okay. Well, that's good. Anyway, so the point is that this is in a nutshell. This kind of, you know, as a general background. And the United States is coming to the period where literally this year, okay, a lot of things are going to be decided. Financially, economically, socially, and the United States is not ready. You have a president who shouldn't be there. And the Democrats in Senate and the Congress, they understand this. And kind of go back to what you said before. That's why they're, you know, leaving in droves, because they know that it'll be routed. And it's better to leave and know when to leave, which is also an art in politics, than to stay too long and be destroyed, which is what's going to happen. Unless they steal the elections in November, and we know that can be done. Force Majeure, war, revolution, Godzilla. You know, maybe they can make up a Godzilla who will appear somewhere from the depth of the ocean. Well, why not?
Well, Daniel Eschelin, you were a perfect guest for what happened to be on at the end of a very tumultuous week. I don't see how you can't get this book. It's only a few months out. There's a link for it in the after the interview section. There's your TV channel. I'm going to put a link there, too, for that. I get nothing from the sales of you, but I do as a courtesy. I think you're a very interesting guy. And your book is lays out the global roadmap and what we may end up with in the end. And I, you know, the pains that the United States has have, I hate it, but we're going to have them. So, Daniel Eschelin.
I don't want people to think that I actually hate America. I do not hate America. I don't hate America at all. Again, we were all for Donald Trump, you know, because we love him.
I think
I don't care. You know, people say, no, no, he, you know, he's a misogynist. You know, he cheats on his wife. I don't have to sleep with him. I don't care who he sleeps with. The only individual who should be concerned about, you know, his nighttime habits is his wife. What we needed from Trump was his leadership to destroy the global liberal order. He started it, but he didn't finish. He scared the living bejesus out of these people, which is why they did what they did and got rid of him. But he wasn't smart enough or courageous enough. I don't know whatever it is that he wasn't enough, but he lost. And the other guy took over, and the other guy took over, and he was going to have his own plan, his own idea, his own vision, his own road. And that lasted about 2 months.
In March of
last year, he basically went back to, I mean, Trump, if you look at Trump's policy and you look at Biden's policy since March of last year, it's a carbon copy. Anyway, we're living in interesting times. And
Do you have a website, too, where you people can...
Well, it's probably the easiest way to find me is... My YouTube channel is Daniel Eschelin. My Twitter feed is @EschelinDaniel. And, we have TV channels, DanielEschelin.tv, which is, subscriber based. Because you know better than most that, you know, unless you follow the liberal banking financier lead, they will cancel you.
Yeah, that's right. You can't say anything against them. You'll send me links for your subscription and your other stuff. I'll put it up free of charge.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for being on. And again, the book, which you'll find a link to the buying page, is the 2045 Global Projects at War.
Projects at War.
Yes. Daniel Eschelin. Thank you, Daniel, for joining us today on USAWatchdog.com.